Greetings, this is Tyler McFeeters with your News Gazette, dated Friday, December 5th, 2025. We'll begin with a front page story. Mr. Van Dyke, you inspire us all. Fisher Fest, the life and legacy of Dick Van Dyke. 100th birthday card available for signing at documentary premiere Saturday. Story by Jennifer Bailey, out of Danville. Want to wish one of Danville's favorite sons a happy 100th? There's a supersized canvas card for that awaiting guests Saturday night at Danville's Fisher Theater, which will host the world premiere of the documentary Dick Van Dyke 100th Celebration. The theater's executive director, Ashton Greer, was the first to sign it this week. Mr. Van Dyke, you inspire us all. Happiest 100th birthday. Leaving plenty of space for the 600 ticket holders expected to attend opening night of the two-day Fisher Fest, The Life and Legacy of Dick Van Dyke. The Emmy, Grammy, and Tony Award-winning birthday boy won't be back in his hometown, but patrons will be able to relive his last visit to Vermilion County. The documentary features memorable moments from his 2016 trip back, said friend and Tripping Over the Ottoman podcast co-host David Van Dusen, who Dick Van Dyke creator Carl Reiner nicknamed The Other DVD. The film captures the essence of the prolific performer, Van Dusen said. I think, as someone summed it up, Dick Van Dyke just seems to exude joy. It doesn't matter what project he was involved in. It's that zeal, that excitement, that joy. The Fisher's two-day celebration will include music from the Danville Symphony Orchestra and the reading of city and state proclamations on Saturday. Sunday's lineup includes screenings of Bye Bye Birdie, The Comic, and Mary Poppins, plus Q&A sessions and critic Chuck Koplinski sharing tidbits about each film. Technically, Van Dyke's birthday isn't for another 8 days. I hope I make it, he joked to People magazine last month. But Danville is celebrating early, starting with the first screening of the documentary by Emmy-winning filmmakers Steve Bocher and Michael Trinklein. It will be shown on screens in Van Dyke's current hometown of Malibu, California, next Sunday, part of the city's two-week Vandy Days celebration. Van Dyke himself got in on the fun this week, leading a two-hour sing-along of Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, and other fan favorites at a charity event benefiting the Dick Van Dyke Museum and the Van Dyke Endowment of the Arts. Between songs, Van Dyke told the crowd he aspires to revive the art of conversation, joking that he might be the only person in the United States over 10 without a cell phone. Said Van Dusen, Dick, in my own opinion, when you meet him, he's exactly as he is, very unassuming and very down to earth. He's the most friendly guy I'd ever want to meet. That's who he is. Maybe it's part of the Midwestern upbringing. Fans can see more of the actor who played Bert the Chimney Sweep in a second documentary starring Dick Van Dyke, debuting on PBS on December 12th, and read more in his new book, 100 Rules for Living to 100, An Optimist's Guide to a Happy Life. Among his pointers, hitting the gym 3 days a week, not being the get-off-my-lawn guy, and singing daily. I hum too, he writes. It does everything for my mental health. David Van Dusen and Dick Van Dyke at Dick Van Dyke's Malibu home provided. And it was a picture of them together. Front page also has a picture in the middle. It's a man seated holding a sword. U.S. Navy veteran Bill McLean shows off a sword that belonged to an officer aboard the USS Arizona, which was sunk 84 years ago Sunday during the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. It's one of many pieces of Pearl Harbor memorabilia that will be showcased this weekend at Sydney American Legion Post 433's Military Museum, which McLean runs. The display will be part of the Sydney Shop at Home Christmas holiday event, with the public invited to drop by between 4 and 8 p.m. Saturday and 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. Sunday at 221 South David Street. The next front page story is Dutch Brothers Coffee, drive-through coffee shop doubling down here. Bob Evans to be torn down to make way for second CU location. Story by Jana Wiersema. Out of Champaign. A former restaurant near Marketplace Shopping Center is slated to be torn down to make way for two new buildings, including one that will house a drive-through coffee shop. Adam Bell, Vice President of Development at Chicago-based Core Acquisitions, said the company has signed a lease with Dutch Brothers Coffee and is also in talks with an interested party that could become the coffee shop's neighbor. The plan is to tear down the former Bob Evans at 1813 North Neal Street and replace it with two freestanding buildings. When asked about the timeline for the Dutch Brothers shop, Bell said Core plans to submit a permit in the next 2 weeks. Once we hit the March timeline and this awful winter's over with, we'll start construction, he said. Our goal is to get it turned over by the summer of next year and have Dutch Brothers operating by the summer. The North Neal Street development will mark the second Dutch Brothers location in CU. An Urbana location at 809 West Green Street is also in the works. For the Urbana location, that one is still on track to open this year, a spokesperson told the News Gazette. Otherwise, we're in the very early stages in Champaign, so we don't have any information to share at this time. As of September 30, 2025, Dutch Brothers has more than 1,000 locations in 24 states. President and CEO Christine Baroni said in a recent quarterly report that the company is confident in its goal of reaching 2,029 shops by 2029. Core Acquisitions bought the North Neal Street property in August. Bob Evans' restaurant at the site closed in October. When asked if he knew why the location closed, Bell replied, "Unfortunately, I can't really speak to that. I don't know anything about their internal operations." Core Acquisitions, not to be confused with Core Spaces, which is also based in Chicago, also owns the Potbellies on Anthony Drive, he said. "We've done a pretty significant amount of development work throughout the central Illinois area," Bell said. "We did the Starbucks and Jersey Mike's up in Rantoul in Champaign County. So we're just very familiar with the area, and we really like this real estate." University of Illinois, building a better mouse escape room. Student-designed game experience featured in IGB Mobile Learning Lab. By Luke Taylor, story. Urbana. Lab researchers around the Carl R. Woos Institute for Genomic Biology are turning into mice thanks to some mysterious scientific discoveries. Or that's what students in two classes centered around game design and art would lead you to believe. The IGB's colorful mobile learning lab has provided educational experiences of many kinds around the community, but right now it's hosting an escape room designed by students in two University of Illinois courses, Designing Immersive Adventures, Escape Rooms, and Makerspace, Escape Rooms. And then there's a picture of Makeda Davies, a senior acting major at the University of Illinois, helps reset clues in an escape room in the Carl O. Woese Institute of Genomic Biology's Mobile Learning Lab. The escape room was created by UI students, and Davies serves as the host for the experience, playing the role of a researcher mistakenly transformed into a mouse. And the story continues on the next page. The former is a collaboration between the theater and game studies and design departments, while the latter falls under informatics. Our class focuses on the gameplay side of the escape room, so how people think through puzzles, what they pay attention to in the room, and basically taking tasks and outlets of the story that Amber's class gives us and figuring out how to turn that into actual playable challenges, said Emily Butt, CU Fab Lab Instruction and Engagement Coordinator. She teaches the Makerspace course alongside Duncan Baird, Game Studies and Design Instructor. Amber Dewey Schultz, Teaching Assistant Professor of Immersive Interactive Theater, teaches the Theater and Game Design course. My class develops the theme based on the client's needs and then develops the story and the dialogue to make sure that we have immersive, embodied storytelling happening, Schultz said. Over the 6 years the courses have been available at the UI, students have worked with a variety of clients, including the Urbana Free Library, the Molecule Maker Lab Institute, and the Museum of the Grand Prairie. They designed the puzzles and themes around the client. Part of the purpose of the course is learning how to design games to meet others' needs and specifications, rather than the students just making things that they would personally enjoy. For this specific escape room, Players have to solve a mystery about why lab researchers are turning into mice before the problem spreads, turning the whole world into mice. It's a science fiction concept, but the idea is to teach younger people some real science while they work their way through the puzzles involved. Eswin Byrd, a senior music tech major with a minor in game studies and design, said that workshopping different ideas and learning how to work with a big team made this a resume-worthy experience. We basically created a bunch of puzzles that were vaguely themed around a bus or science because we knew the client. Once they came in, we pitched all of our puzzles, Byrd said. We got some feedback like, this is a really cool idea, but can we lean a bit more into educational aspects, and tuned our puzzles to the client's needs. Jimmy Rydell, a senior information science major, had a puzzle centered around proper lab safety, while Byrd's focused on a specific scientific process. It was kind of tough to make it both educational and fun, but I feel like we had a really good balance for that, Rydell said. He also praised the students who focused on theming and decoration in the room, as well as those who worked hard on fabricating parts of the puzzles for their hard work. Students had access to the Fab Lab, so they used all sorts of tools and processes like 3D printing, laser cutting, soldering, sewing, just about anything they could need. While many of the students were involved in the actual creative processes, the goal of the course is for them to work as a team, as if they were a real game design studio. So some took on roles in more management aspects. Rachel Glass, a junior information sciences major with a minor in business, worked as a project manager. Her main job was helping coordinate between the fabrication team, the gameplay design team, and the environment team from the theater class. It was important because we had to meet the client's needs, but we can't go out of our way designing something we don't want to do because then nobody's happy, Glass said. Turning now to national and world news. January 6, 2021, Capitol attack. Suspected pipe bomb planter jailed, charged. Story by Dave Goldiner, New York Daily News, TNS. A suspect has been arrested and charged with planting twin pipe bombs outside the Washington, D.C. headquarters of the two major parties on the eve of the January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol, officials said Thursday. The arrest marks a stunning breakthrough in the puzzling, long-unsolved case that occurred alongside the violent riot by thousands of President Donald Trump's supporters. The suspect was identified as Brian Cole, NBC News first reported, citing two senior law enforcement officials. The arrest took place in suburban Woodbridge, Virginia, about 20 miles from the crime scenes. The bust took place Thursday morning, and the suspect is a man, said a government official familiar with the bust. No other details were immediately available, like a potential motive or possible charges. The pipe bombs were planted on the evening of January 5, 2021, near the offices of the Democratic and Republican National Committees in Washington, D.C., surveillance footage showed. Nobody was hurt and the bombs were safely defused by authorities, but the FBI has said both devices could have been lethal. In the nearly 5 years since the attempted bombings, investigators have sought the public's help in identifying a shadowy subject captured on surveillance camera footage. But they have never revealed whether the attempted bombings were directly linked to the January 6 attack, like perhaps to distract or divert law enforcement from the planned rally headlined by Trump and the march to the Capitol that followed. Hours after the bombs were placed, Trump delivered a fiery speech at the White House Ellipse in which he told thousands of supporters to fight like hell to keep him in power, despite his 2020 electoral loss to Joe Biden. The MAGA mob marched to the Capitol, overwhelmed police, and stormed the building in hopes of blocking Congress from certifying Biden's Electoral College win. Another story in national and world news. White House, submission of ballroom plans expected this month. Second architect added to $30 million project. Out of Washington in the AP. The White House is expected to submit plans for President Donald Trump's new ballroom to a federal planning commission before the year ends, about 3 months after construction began. Will Scharf, who was named by Trump as chairman of the National Capital Planning Commission, said at the panel's monthly meeting Thursday that he was told by colleagues at the White House that the long-awaited plans will be filed sometime in December. Once plans are submitted, that's really when the role of this commission and its professional staff will begin, said Scharf, who is also one of the Republican president's top White House aides. He said the review process would happen at a normal and deliberative pace. Separately, the White House confirmed Thursday that a second architectural firm has been added to the project. Spokesperson Davis Engel said architect Shalom Baranes of Washington, D.C. was needed as construction moves into a new phase. The firm has worked on federal properties across the nation's capital, including the Pentagon and Treasury buildings, according to its website. As we begin to transition into the next stage of development on the White House ballroom, the administration is excited to share that the highly talented Shalom Baranes has joined the team of experts to carry out President Trump's vision on building what will be the greatest addition to the White House since the Oval Office, the White House ballroom, Engel said in an emailed statement. Shalom is an accomplished architect whose work has shaped the architectural identity of our nation's capital for decades, and his experience will be a great asset to the completion of this project, Engel said. The initial firm, McCreary Architects, also of Washington, remains as a consultant. If built as proposed, the 90,000-square-foot ballroom announced over the summer and expected to be ready before Trump's term ends in 2029 would dwarf the White House itself, yet nearly double the size, and the president has said it will accommodate 999 people. The estimated price tag stands at $300 million, up from the White House's initial $200 million. Trump has said the ballroom will not cost taxpayers a dime because it is being privately funded by individuals he says are patriots, American corporations, and himself. He has not said how much of his own money he is contributing. The White House has released a list of 37 donors that includes crypto billionaires, charitable organizations, sports team owners, powerful financiers, tech and tobacco giants, media companies, supporters of Republican causes, and some of the president's neighbors in Palm Beach, Florida. Trump has long desired a ballroom at the White House, and he complains regularly about the inability of its two largest rooms, the State Dining Room and the East Room, to host large events. He also has panned the use of large tents set up on the South grounds for 100-plus person events, like a state dinner. Last month, when Saudi Arabia's crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, visited, Trump said he had upset a lot of people because he had to turn down their request to attend an East Room dinner in the prince's honor due to the lack of space. "I only wish we had about 2,000 more seats. We would have filled every one of them two times over," Trump said at the dinner, alluding to the proposed ballroom. "But very soon you'll be having that, and we'll have to do another one in about 2 years from now." In September, Trump moved ahead with site preparation work for the ballroom, despite the lack of sign-off from the National Capital Planning Commission, the executive branch agency with jurisdiction over construction and major renovations to government buildings in the region. And then there's a picture of an excavator sitting in the rubble after the east wing of the White House was demolished October 28th in Washington, D.C. The demolition is part of President Donald Trump's plan to build a ballroom on the eastern side of the White House. Another national and world story, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE official calls nativity scene sad political rhetoric. Story by Tim Dunn out of the Boston Herald, TNS. A church in Dedham, Massachusetts, has drawn reaction from top brass at Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, after placing a sign in its nativity scene that reads, "ICE was here, where Mary Joseph and baby Jesus were supposed to be." The sign on the display outside St. Susanna Parish and was the idea of the Reverend Stephen Joselma. Underneath the "ICE was here" message, the sign goes on to read, "The Holy Family is safe in our church. If you see ICE, please call Luce at 617-370-5023. Acting ICE Director Todd Lyons responded to the display in an interview with the Boston Herald, calling it sad political rhetoric that only adds fuel to the fire of political division. It's very sad, especially during the holiday season. ICE agents and officers are human beings too. We don't want to be referred to in things like that. The brave men and women of ICE are out there doing a dangerous job every day. And I hate to say it, but people are taking corny things like this decoration to make a point on the backs of our men and women and the job they're doing every day. All that is doing is adding fuel to the fire, Lyons told the Herald. We aren't snatching babies, we aren't snatching families. Now, if you're here in the country illegally and came here as a family unit, that's a different story. But we're not out there separating children, and we're not out there separating families. Felon after felon after felon is being arrested by ICE Boston every day and all over New England, yet nobody is focusing on that. All they're focusing on is this political rhetoric, and I don't know what point they're trying to make, he said. The parish has a history of political activism in the form of demonstrations and signs, like one in the nativity scene. On its website, the parish even posted a picture promoting the sign at the nativity scene. The parish also has an official Facebook page where they posted images of the altered creche. A user labeled as the page administrator, Phil Mandeville, posted a picture of the sign to Facebook, commenting that he is extremely thankful to be a member of this parish, and defending the Reverend Josoma. Father Steve is an inspiration to us all. I have to say, I don't recognize a lot of names that have made posts here. I wonder why that is. This parish follows the words of Jesus. Welcome the stranger and feed the poor. Christ set an example for us to follow. Call out injustice wherever and whenever you see it. He was never afraid to call out the politicians of the time for being hypocrites, Mandeville said. The sin is remaining silent in the face of injustice. Christ always mixed religion and politics. Next story in the National and World News is out of the Justice Department. Another acting U.S. attorney's appointment called into question. Out of Albany, New York, in the AP. President Donald Trump's effort to install political loyalists as top federal prosecutors has run into a legal buzzsaw lately, with judges ruling that his handpicked U.S. attorneys for New Jersey, Eastern Virginia, Nevada, and Los Angeles were all serving unlawfully. On Thursday, another federal judge heard an argument by New York Attorney General Letitia James that the administration also twisted the law to make John Sarcone the acting U.S. attorney for Northern New York. James, a Democrat, is challenging Sarcone's authority to oversee a Justice Department investigation into regulatory lawsuits she filed against Trump and the National Rifle Association. It's one of several arguments she is making to block subpoenas issued as part of the probe, which her lawyers say is part of a campaign of baseless investigations and prosecution of Trump's perceived enemies. Her attorney, Haylin Chen, argued in court that since Sarcone lacks legitimate authority to act as U.S. attorney, legal steps taken by him in that capacity, like the subpoenas, are unlawful. In response to a question from U.S. District Judge Lorna G. Schofield, Chen said Sarcone should be disqualified from the investigation and the office. Sarcone exercised power that he did not lawfully possess, Chen told the judge. Justice Department lawyers say Sarcone was appointed properly, and the motion to block the subpoena should be denied. Assistant U.S. Attorney Richard Bellis argued that disqualifying Sarcone would be drastic and extreme. We don't think that's a proper remedy, Bellis said. Schofield, after peppering both attorneys with questions, did not say when she would rule. And the next National and World News is U.S. Supreme Court. New Texas map cleared for use for now. Out of Washington and the AP. A divided Supreme Court on Thursday came to the rescue of Texas Republicans, allowing next year's elections to be held under the state's congressional redistricting plan favorable to the GOP and pushed by President Donald Trump, despite a lower court ruling that the map likely discriminates on the basis of race. With conservative justices in the majority, the court acted on an emergency request from Texas for quick action because qualifying in the new districts already has begun, with primary elections in March. The Supreme Court's order puts the 2-1 ruling blocking the map on hold at least until after the High Court issues a final decision in the case. Justice Samuel Alito had previously temporarily blocked the order while the full court considered the Texas appeal. The justices cast doubt on the lower court finding that race played a role in the new map, saying in an unsigned statement that Texas lawmakers had avowedly partisan goals. In dissent, Justice Elena Kagan wrote for the three liberal justices that her colleagues should not have intervened at this point. Doing so, she wrote, ensures that many Texas citizens, for no good reason, will be placed in electoral districts because of their race. And that result, as this court has pronounced year in and year out, is a violation of the Constitution. The High Court's vote is a green light for there to be even more redistricting, and a strong message to lower courts to butt out, Richard Hansen, an election law expert at the University of California at Los Angeles Law School, wrote on the Election Law blog. Next story is in local, downtown Champaign. Homeless shelter for families with children opens. Story by Rob Lacates, out of Champaign. With temperatures plummeting into the single digits, the Champaign County Regional Planning Committee has opened its first seasonal overflow shelter for families with children under 18 years old. The first-come, first-served pilot program screens families at a remote facility at 307 South Neal Street. Once approved, they can check into the shelter, which is within a half mile, also in downtown Champaign. The RPC isn't releasing the shelter's specific location in the interest of guest safety. The shelter can hold around 8 households each night, with a capacity of 24 individuals. There is no limit to how often a family can stay. Jesse Heckenmuller, the RPC's Assistant Director of Community Services, said the program stemmed from a community need. I think that all families in our community are valuable and worthy of safety, support, and dignity, she said. And from my perspective, this is important because this is one way that we're able to offer housing and also learn how we can continue to improve what is offered, how it's offered, and how it meets the need within our community. Families seeking shelter should arrive at the screening office before doors open at 7 p.m. and close at 7:30 p.m. Families are allowed to stay if they meet these guidelines. The head of household needs to be related to or a legal guardian of the children under 18 years of age and directly supervise them. They must be Champaign County residents. They bring only what is required to stay the night, which excludes items that pose threats to the space or other guests, as well as alcohol or drug paraphernalia. Families must arrive at the shelter by 8 p.m. to be let in and can stay until 7:30 the next morning. The shelter offers complimentary water bottles and semi-private sleeping quarters furnished with air mattresses or cribs. There is no restriction on food brought into the space, and the shelter offers light snacks for those without. In August, the RPC received a $175,000 grant from the City of Urbana to maintain the shelter from early November to April. Support was also provided from the Housing Authority of Champaign County, other donors, and volunteers. We're really grateful that we were awarded that funding opportunity to do so, Heckenmuller said. The organization will collect data from the intake form to gather information to inform future long-term family shelter expansion efforts. The RPC will work with families experiencing consistent housing insecurity by connecting them with a centralized intake homeless system and accessing other options for when the seasonal shelter ends. In years past, the RPC bought hotel rooms for families, but stopped due to costs. Bryce Decker, the program manager, said the program is well worth it. I believe we actually have the ability to succeed, and I think it's worthwhile, he said. I think people should have a chance to live full lives, not having to worry about freezing, or knowing what's happening to them night to night is worth it. And we will take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the News Gazette, dated December 5th, 2025. Please stay tuned.